Nancy Murray, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Let me start where your memoir begins, when you were a teenager in 1979. Paint a picture for us of who you were and what was going on in your life at this time when you found out that you were pregnant.
Well, I had been for a good amount of time slipping away, I think, as a teenager. I was the youngest of six children in an intact nuclear family, but a very dysfunctional one that was struggling with a lot of secrets. And I found myself pretty lost and missing school and gravitating towards other lost people. And we were getting in trouble together and dabbling in drugs and doing the things that lost children and sometimes all teenagers do at a point. But I was going a little too far with it.
You ended up pregnant. And what was your initial reaction to this news, this discovery?
Well, it took me a while to figure out that I was pregnant because I was very new to, I had only had one period. I was only, I was just very naive in a lot of ways.
What age were you at this point?
I was 16.
16 years old.
Yeah. And a little bit of a late bloomer. And so I didn't put it together. And when I was sick almost immediately, and my parents acted as if I had the flu, and I was, you know, I went with that for quite a while. And then I started getting suspicious in school, talking with kids, and realizing that maybe something was more was going on.
So a time came to have a conversation with your parents about this. Talk about how that happened.
Well, I honestly couldn't find a way to talk to my parents about it. So I thought it would be better to just leave home and run away from my parents. My father was a volatile person. He was dangerous in a lot of ways. And my mother was, I don't know, he was a victim of his energy as well. So I felt like the best thing for me to do would be to just leave. But I called them before I left because I was frightened. You know, you won't call your mother. So I called my mom, and they suspected something was wrong. And my mother said for me to come home, not to be stupid and to come home. So I went home and sat at the table and cried and told them. And they didn't really ask a lot of questions about how I got there. It was just, you know, well, we've got to figure out what to do.
The father of this baby, by the way, was essentially, you put him out of the picture. You decided not to tell him.
I didn't really have a relationship with this father. I didn't feel that he was a person that should know.
All that is to say, this was selectively shared information. You were in this situation, you had a conversation with your parents, and your mom, it turns out, sort of surprised you by being remarkably sort
there.
Of practical and a guide for you about your options. Talk about where those conversations went and what happened from there.
My mother surprised me because my mother was very strong. And I had formulated an opinion of my mother that she was very weak because of her relationship with my father and because of what she allowed my father to do and get away with. So I had developed an entire storyline about my mother that was proved, at least to a certain extent, false when this happened, because she rose to the occasion, pushed my father aside and said, we're going to deal with this, we're going to take care of this. And she was my champion through the whole experience. So,
and Nancy, you're sort of talking around this situation with your father in this conversation. In the book, you explain in no uncertain terms that he was sexually abusing you.
Yes, from the time I was 3 years old until I left home.
With that situation happening, with your mother complicit to some degree, as you understood as a child in this situation, your mother surprised you by really stepping up in your defense in this situation. Here you are, a teenager. What do you decide to do from here? What is the next step for you?
Well, I had already decided what I wanted to do before the conversation with my parents happened. So I was able to offer that during our conversation. I had already taken a trip to Planned Parenthood. And I had done a little bit of research, and I had made the decision that I was going to place the child for adoption. So I already knew that much. It was just a matter of telling my mother that that was the way it was going to be. And she said, okay, and, you know, took the ball and ran with it. I was too young and inexperienced to know to find adoption agencies or find, you know, this home where I could stay or what I could do. I had decided I wanted no one to know about it because I thought if people know about it, it would be harder for me to follow through with it and do it.
Let me ask you, Nancy, if you ever considered an abortion, what was that in the way of an option for you at this time?
At this time, it was not an option. I had been molested my whole life. I felt my whole life not good and in some ways not innocent. Like, I never really had that sense that I was innocent or that there was innocence in me. So when I was looking into the options and I was considering abortion, in fact, I thought initially that I would have an abortion. But when I was looking into the options, I was struck by a photo of a fetus, a fetus that had fingernails and toenails, and I was struck by it, and I felt protective of it. I don't have any feeling that there's only one choice here that's correct. I think that if I had chosen to have an abortion, that would be a fine choice as well. I just didn't, because I wanted to protect the one thing that I felt was innocent that was inside of me, and I wanted to keep it. Does that make sense?
It's your own personal story.
Yeah, and I respect every person's personal story and wherever that takes them. So
understood. You're listening to The Signal here on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin. If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Nancy Murray about her memoir, One Child for Another. It's the story of her experience as a teenage girl, a 16-year-old, in 1980 when she became pregnant and made the decision to give her child up for adoption. And Nancy, talk about what it was like when you basically arranged to kind of drop off the grid, off the face of the earth, so to speak, and go to this very secluded place, St. Anne's Infant and Maternity Home.
It was somewhat terrifying. It was scary. My friends were my community. I was very delinquent in school. All I had really were my friends, and I was not telling my friends where I was. My mother was not telling our relatives where I was. There was a story being made up, and I was going to this place. It was very much like a hospital, and I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what having a baby was going to be like, and I felt very alone and scared, really scared.
This was basically a residence for pregnant girls, teenagers.
Actually, it was more like a home for children who had no parents, had no families, had been taken out of their homes and not yet placed in foster care. But there was a second floor that was a big secret at the time, and that was for the unwed mothers.
What was it like? You moved into the room. The place is run by nuns.
I was belligerent. It's funny, it was my choice to be there, and yet I was belligerent when I got there. I didn't like people telling me what to do. The nuns seemed very matter-of-fact and hard to me. Looking back, I can see that they weren't, but they had to deal with these kids, but I didn't know it when I was a kid. So I was angry and belligerent and defiant at first. I mentioned in the book the Raggedy Ann that's on the, as the elevator opens up, there was this giant Raggedy Ann that was smiling. And I know it was their attempt to make it seem homey and cheerful, but to me it was this grotesque horror film, you know, character looking at me every time. I hated it. So yeah, it's your perspective when you come in that shapes how it looks.
You also had a choice to make when you were there about whether or not to bond or not bond with the other young mothers-to-be who were there.
Right? I didn't want to bond with anybody.
Right.
I thought any bonding that happened while I was pregnant was going to result in a more difficult choice to let go of the child. And I knew, there was no doubt in my mind because of my father, that I was not bringing this child into my home. And I knew I couldn't take it outside and take care of it because I was too young. So I didn't want to get used to being pregnant. I didn't want to get used to having pregnant friends. I didn't want to get used to any of it. So I pretty much stayed in my room for the bulk of the time and didn't bond with people.
And these were peers who were going through the same ups and downs about this baby and the decision about, you know, wanting to keep the baby versus wanting to give up the baby. Some of them kept their babies. Some of them gave their babies up for adoption.
In the 7 months that I was there, only one other girl actually gave her baby up for adoption. All of the others kept them. So that was one of the struggles that we had, was that the girls came in, all of them, saying they were going to place it for adoption. And then one by one, they brought it home. So that was part of why I couldn't bond with people.
Were there pressures along the way to keep the baby?
I don't think there were pressures, but it felt like pressures. We had to take classes. We had to take parenting classes. And the parenting classes were, you know, they talked about how you'll play peekaboo with your baby. It'll get used to your face. It'll start to imitate you. And if you know you're going to give the baby up for adoption, that's a dagger to the heart. You can't sit there and listen to that. But most of the girls did go to the classes, and, you know, that's a happy thought. You know, oh, I'm going to have this baby, and it's going to look at me and get used to my face and love me. And I think you get used to that idea, and then you don't want to give it up when it's gone.
Tell me about the day that you gave birth to your son.
I think it was the scariest day of my life. You know, I tried really, really hard to be tough and to be strong and to be older than I was and to be, you know, worldly, but I wasn't. I was just a kid. I was scared. My mother wasn't there because it all happened so fast. I waited a long time before I told the nuns that I was in labor. And by the time I did tell them, it was coming, and they had to get my mother there, and she had a ways to go, and so she wasn't there. And then things went wrong. They did an epidural, and it stopped everything. And then they did another drug to induce everything again. And then I had a reaction to all the drugs. So I was sick. I was shaking. I was terrified. And my mom wasn't there. And there were strangers all around me. I ended up punching one of the nurses who was trying to pin me down. And it was horrible. it was horrible.
Once your son was born, how did things go from there? How much time did you get to spend with him before he was taken away?
Well, we were a few days in the hospital, but I had a fever. I don't know if it was because of all the mix of drugs or reaction to something, but I had a fever, and they wouldn't let him come in to see me. So I only had, you know, 3 days total, and two of those days they wouldn't bring him in because I had this fever. So that was terrible too. But then he did come in the day that I was getting discharged from the hospital, and I did spend a few hours with him in the morning.
Is there any way to put the emotions of those few hours into words?
Surreal. You know, you're filled with this overwhelming love for this child, and you want to kind of get it all in there right away, all at once, because you're never going to see him again.
Nancy Murray is the author of the memoir One Child for Another, here on The Signal. In 1980, when she was a 16-year-old girl, she gave birth to a son, Dylan, his name, and made the decision to have him placed for adoption. And Nancy, tell me about what you were able or allowed to know about his adoptive parents and, like, how things went from there.
I think I was right on the cusp of when things started changing for adoption. And I think at the time that it happened with me, it was very common to have an adoption be completely closed. But I think right after that time, they started opening up quite a bit. So for me, I was not going to have any contact until he was 18, if he came to find me. I was allowed to leave information at the agency. And if he came to the agency, they would give it to him, but they wouldn't forward it to him.
Before we fast forward in time, Nancy, talk to me about what it was like to go back home from the hospital without a baby and back to your family.
It's strange because the situation at home was difficult. There were comforts at home, you know, my mother's cooking and my sister's dog was there. And there were comforts that I wanted desperately to get back to. But my father was also there. So there were dangers that I didn't want to have anymore. But they were all waiting. It was all waiting for me all at once. So at first I was elated to be home and comfortable around my stuffed animals and my drawings and things like that. But it didn't take long before we got back into the other stuff, and that was not good.
It seems you had changed a bit as a person, though, as a result of this experience. And your relationship with your abusive father, that came to a point where it changed as well.
That ended.
Yeah.
That was over. You don't know when something starts in your life at such a young age, you don't know that there are other options. But when I went away to St. Anne's, it was 7 months where I was safe. And where people, as you know, as rugged as they were or as strong as they were in their personalities, they were kind people who were taking care of children is what they were doing. And that was a good thing for me to experience. And it made me realize that I deserve to be taken care of and I deserve to be safe, if nothing else. So when my father tried to start again, I refused to let him. I mean, the name of the book is One Child for Another, because the experience took away what was left of my childhood in exchange for Dylan having a safe childhood. Because I was very much a grown-up when I came back. I was very much a different person.
You did become an adult. You did move out of the house. Life went on for you. Tell me about the sense of mystery that lingers in the years after you give a baby up for adoption. And then maybe in your case, how that mystery has, resolved itself.
When my mother passed away, I went back to the agency, and Dylan had been there. He had been there 2 years earlier, and he left a photo for me, and that's the photo that's on the cover of the book. And he was 8 years old when he left the picture, but he was 10 years old when I picked it up from the agency. So it had a picture of, I don't know if you can see it on the cover, I might have edited it out, but it had a picture of the Washington Post, and I realized he was near. So for years, I looked for that little boy. Whenever I was in Washington or Tacoma Park, I suspected he lived in Tacoma Park. And I would look in people's backyards to see if I could see a porch that looked like the porch in that picture. And for years, I looked for that little boy, even though as the years passed, he wouldn't be that little boy anymore. He would be 18 or 19 years old, but I was still looking for that little boy everywhere.
He was 8 when he left this picture for you, 10 when you found it. And then he was able to reach out and be in touch with you once he turned 18.
Right.
He has been back in touch with you. Talk about what it's been like to hear from him, reunite with him, and meet him as an adult.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful Disney version of the story. There's also a deeper, more complex version of the story. We certainly enjoyed the Disney version. You know, Dylan loved introducing me and his mother. We did forums about adoption. We were kind of the poster children for doing adoption right. So it was all very charming and wonderful.
Because he turned out to be a great kid. He's a great young man. And
lucky to have a fantastic family. His family, he grew up with, and with a considerable amount more money than I ever grew up with. So they lived very well. In fact, I told my daughters, now you're going to meet Dylan, and when you meet him you're going and see how he's been living, you're going to wish that mommy put you up for adoption too. I said to him, it's okay for you to think that. You just don't say it out loud. It's probably not best to say it out loud. Of course, they were sweet enough to say, no, mommy, we'd never want that.
So there is that kind of Disney movie version of tears of happiness and being reunited.
Absolutely.
But as you say, there are layers and layers of emotional complexity for everyone involved below that surface.
There was the question of the father. I mean, his birth certificate says father unknown. I knew who the father was, but the book explains why it ended up being father unknown. But I had to go back to a terrible time in my life to talk with him about the beginning of his life. And I wanted to do it in a very positive way, but the first couple of times we went back into the past together and I told him, I didn't tell him all of the darkness that was there. I tried to whitewash it as much as possible. But then when he'd leave, he lives in California, he'd leave, and I would not go to bed for a few days. It wrung me out to do it.
He's read this book.
Yeah.
He essentially helped serve as a editor and advisor on this book.
He did. His mother did too. His mother and father both read it.
Did you write it for them? For yourself, what compelled you to write this book?
I think people talk a lot about the reunions of birth mothers and their children when they come back, and they talk about parents who are looking for children in adoption. But the story of what the birth mother actually goes through, I don't see a lot of that story. And there's beauty, even though it's a harder story. It's not as sweeping and fun as the happy endings, but there's beauty in it too. I mean, there's beauty in a person making that kind of a choice and going all the way to the end with it.
Nancy Murray is the author of One Child for Another. You can find out more about her story and her other work online at bemorenancy.com. And Nancy Murray, thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks so much for having me here.